I'm sitting here with Professor Dr. Gerald Schroeder, who is a man who is dealing with a subject which is, with the confluence of two subjects. One is the Bible, and the beginning of the Bible that says, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created, and with the physics of the creation. And I'm wondering, sir, how you came to put these two areas together.
The Genesis relates to a few sources. One comes from primarily, as I entered in Genesis of the Big Bang, my first book, I say that my kids had questions, and then people with whom I learned had questions. And, you know, how can the world be billions of years old and only 6 days old plus a few thousand years since Adam? Can rocks and water really become alive? Or, hominids go back 60,000, 70,000 years, and Adam goes back less than 6,000 years. Those are questions that if you have a science background, they're answerable.
So we were talking about the confluence of science biblical knowledge. Do you have a background in both science and Bible?
Well, everyone's got a background in science. You look out the window and you see nature, science. The question is, do you know the formulas that go by behind it? Background in Bible is more isolated, let's say. But my background in science is, thank God, with no design of my part ever, just stumbling along. I have 3 degrees from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Institute, in Cambridge, Mass. I have my bachelor's degree in engineering, my master's, and my doctorate in the earth sciences and in physics. It's a single doctorate in two fields, and that led to some very interesting work in different parts of the world. And then I stayed on the staff of MIT for about 7 years before I moved to Israel. So thank God in the background in science I have. In theology or in the Bible, first of all, I grew up in nature. From our house, it seems strange that 40 miles from New York City, we actually had a house where you could not see any of the houses from your house. Okay, about 40 miles out on Long Island. But I'm dating myself because this goes back to the 50s and the 60s and, in those days when there was actually what's called rural Long Island that close to Manhattan. In fact, my parents commuted every day from, it's a town called Brookville, and they commuted by the Long Island Railroad every day to Manhattan. They had a small business there and back at home, and we had an orchard. And it's interesting because when you work with your work in nature, I'm talking about my background in theology, put it that way, then Bible comes after. I don't know, it wasn't by design, and I don't know if I'm just fantasizing it, but when I look back on time, the flow of nature, it's a mistake to think it's a cycle. It's a helix, because if the winter comes every year, spring comes every year, summer, but you're never the same in the next winter as you were last winter, or the trees, etc. We had an orchard, and it's a lot of time to contemplate. And every winter, we'd prune, because especially prune the apple trees. It wasn't a huge orchard. We had about 50 trees, which isn't small, but it's not like commercial. It was totally family type thing. And we also had a woods, and it was a few acres of land. But it's a very intimate relationship that you have with nature. I wouldn't say I was religious then. I wasn't going to, I was bar mitzvahed. I'm Jewish. I was bar mitzvahed, but that was more like a ticket out than a ticket in. And but something seeps in when you see the flow of nature, especially when you work with it intimately. I mean, it's not surprising to me that Moses didn't get his revelation in the middle of a city. He was out in the end of the Midbar. There's a lot of drashing on that, but the fact is, take it literally. When you are exposed to nature, when you see this, when you could actually see in those days the Milky Way every night, in other words, and you see how the trees, exactly how they progress through time. It's the same apple tree each year, but it's different also. It's a year older, and I was a year older. So I'd like to believe that that's what kind of got me into this whole idea of the flow of nature, which would be that, in fact, is probably what led me to go to MIT. I mean, that's probably the background of it, just being that intimately close with the science of nature. The theology then came when I was at MIT, where the one thing led, I became interested. Undergraduate, I had no contact with the Jewish society, and maybe a minuscule amount. They called me occasionally a minion. But by grad school, I started to get more interested into it. I went to graduate school at MIT, and along in that period, when I was going for my doctorate, I had the opportunity to witness an atomic bomb detonated. And it was sometime around Rosh Hashanah. I have a feeling, I think it might have been on Rosh Hashanah, as a matter of fact, which shows you I was asked to go by MIT, by Tech, to go out to do some research on the effect of the seismic wave that comes out of it. First you have a shock wave, but then it changes to a seismic wave, changes the ground. I was looking for some changes in permeability. It turned out we did develop a system for locating clandestine nuclear explosions. You know, clandestine being underground, not in space, underground, by the effect of the seismic wave on the soil structure. And I came back from that first explosion. I've seen a fair number of nuclear bombs exploded. Underground is a euphemism. The event takes underground, but it comes out the top also. I mean, in fact, after the first event, we had to flee back of the first bomb. We called them events. God forbid you call them bombs. We had to flee off the back of the mountain. One of my Genesis in the Big Bang has this account, the opening chapter. We had to flee off the back of the mountain because this radioactive cloud, which is totally invisible, but the Geiger counters pick it up very nicely, was moving towards us. In other words, the event was underground, but the radioactivity had escaped, and we had to flee bouncing off the back of the mountain. The front of the mountain was all gone. There was no escape road any longer. Luckily, two things. I wasn't in my own car. I was in a Department of Defense pickup truck with my technician. So bouncing is one thing, different when it's your own car going over rocks versus the military. You know. I mean, I wasn't casual about it, but because we didn't break any tires, we got out. I got back to, this is, you're 120 miles out of Las Vegas, but Vegas is where I would sleep at night. You drive it flat out. Once you're off the site is difficult. Obviously in the Wadi, bouncing off the back, I wasn't driving, I was trying to avoid the boulders. But to make a short story long, I got back to Vegas. I told my technician, Shorty, his name was, wonderful guy, I said, just don't mention this. I mean, fat chance he wasn't going to mention it to his wife, but I said, don't mention it, because we had to flee from this cloud of radioactive gas that came out the top. Is that this is all classified until maybe 10 years ago. And I get back to the hotel, and I voted myself an evening off. So I'm sitting by the pool at the Thunderbird Motel Hotel. I mean, this is 15, 20 years ago. Just magnificent. You know, spending 2 days in the Nevada test site on the Mesa, you get pretty dusty, etc. So I'm sitting by the pool, having showered and having taken a swim, relaxing on what you call those chairs that go back. And all of a sudden, I hear my name being paged. Gerald Schroeder, you have a phone call. It's Major Adams, no less the man in charge of the site, the technical aspect of the site. He said, Schroeder, yeah, it's me. What you saw today, actually by then it was partly yesterday, what you saw today, don't mention it to anyone. It's completely classified. What was classified? I learned the next day in the news. America tests its first nuclear weapon since the moratorium of X number of years ago, because the Russians had tested just before this. It goes back in the 1960s. And no release of radioactivity. You understand, we had to flee off the back of the mountain to get away from the whole front of the mountain had fallen away. There was no escape route that way in any event. And in fact, that was legally true, because the statement of escape from radioactivity is, did the radioactivity leave your national borders? Well, by the first day, the radioactivity had not left the national borders. You know, a few days later, the Canadians were breathing it. But by that time, it was completely true.
This, in some way, inspired you to looking into the theology, what we call the theology?
Well, that event, that nuclear weapons test that I had just talking about, was so interesting. And it was the first time the U.S. had ever tested in almost a half a decade, or maybe longer. So the technology wasn't known. In fact, the person that had designed the bomb had said he'd be willing to stand at ground zero and just bend his knees to absorb the shock. Well, he would have been put into outer space. If you want to continue to have a free life and not be drawn into the magnificent essence of the spirituality behind the creation, if you want to avoid that in your life, don't study, okay? Just keep enjoying the colors of the fall leaves or wherever you happen to be. But once you get into the integration between the subtlety of nature and then ancient biblical commentary, you don't have to steer clear of modern commentary, but ancient commentary, which is so deep, and you see this integration, the Hebrew word is a shiluv, this integration between how nature works itself and the descriptions of the world from these ancient commentators who didn't know modern physics, at least not in the terminology we have, I began to realize, and I think it's a general feeling, that it almost draws you in because they're both so deep. The subtleties of nature, the beauty of nature, and the beauty of how these ancient commentators saw this essence behind the subtleties of nature, that it's really almost like it's one tapestry woven with two different types of threads, but it's still one tapestry. And that got me, the more talks that I gave, the more of the tapestry I saw. And before long, I was doing things that would be, I guess, pretty much related to Orthodox Judaism, putting on tefillin, etc. I moved to Israel. It's called Aliyah. I moved to Israel in 1971 with every thought of going back in 6 or 7 months. I had no thought of staying now. This recording is taking place in Jerusalem, in case you're not aware of it. And I had no thoughts of going back. One thing led to another. I met my wife, Barbara Sofer, the writer and the radio author, Barbara Sofer. And then one thing led to another, and here I am, 38 years later, for many reasons. And one of the reasons was you just see this magnificent integration between the science and the Bible. I didn't start working on this integration right away. It was always in the background, but a series of very lovely coincidences got me introduced through Barbara, actually, to a literary agent, Helen Reese. She was in town. She gave us a call. This is maybe 3 years after Barbara had met her in the States, where we were on a sabbatical leave from Israel. And Helen Reese said, "I'm in town." And Barbara said, "Come and have us for a Friday night meal. Come for Friday night meal," which just happened to be Parsha Bereishit, the opening of the first section. We say Parsha means a section of Bereishit, the opening section of the Bible, the beginning section, the creation chapter. And I gave my little word of Torah. And Helen Reese, the literary agent, enjoyed, stayed, was at the door. She walked at the door. I can see to this day, and it's almost 25 years ago. She turned around at the door. She said, "Jerry, what you said tonight is a book. Write it." And that was the beginning of Genesis and the Big Bang. What is the connection? Well, that's exactly the essence. That's the essence of the first book. Genesis and the Big Bang talks about Genesis from a Bible point of view and the creation of the universe and the development of life from a science point of view. And when you get back to commentators from before modern science, because that's if you're going to try to see whether there's an integration, the Hebrew word is a shiluv, an integration between biblical commentary and modern science, you have to steer clear of modern commentators, because all modern commentators, they didn't have to go to MIT, but they sure know some science, because you pick it up just in the news and all the time. So I limited myself to ancient biblical commentary, go back 1,000 or so years, 1,000, 2,000 years, and modern science. And the relationship between the two is without bending either. That's important. You have to take the words and understand it. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, we take especially like Nachmanides, the Ramban, in the year 1250, and Maimonides in the year 1190, long before modern science. And they talk about the universe starting as a small point. A point, in fact, that is related, depends which of the commentators, not bigger than the black of your eye, doka ayin, or not bigger than a grain of mustard, never saying the size, but always giving the upper limit. Nachmanides says not bigger than a grain of mustard, the Kabbalist Nachmanides, and that was the entire creation. That was it. And everything is made from that. And that speck, not bigger than a grain of mustard. And why a grain of mustard? Because in ancient times, before microscopes, you could identify what a grain of mustard was. That starts to limit what you can identify. Dust floating in the air is smaller than a grain of mustard, but you can't tell what it is. But a grain of mustard, you can, so that's what they considered one of the smallest items visible that is identifiable as to what it was, hence the use of that term. In other words, it didn't say it was the size of a grain of mustard. It was not bigger than a grain of mustard. And this is that this speck was the entire physical creation. Well, that's pretty amazing, because I look around the room we're sitting in now, and it's a lot bigger than a grain of mustard. Where did it come from? And they point out that as the universe progressed, this speck expanded. Not like a cabbage or an onion or lettuce with new layers. That would be new stuff. This was and Nachmanides comes down very hard on this. This was the only physical creation of stuff and space. Well, you and I both know that the space we're sitting in right now is a lot bigger than a grain of mustard, although they had very special mustard back in those days. So what does it mean? It means that there's no new space made. Space stretches. That the space of this grain of mustard stretches out. Not that there's new space. These ancient commentaries, and that's why you want to steer clear of modern commentary, because modern commentators already know that space expands. You don't have to have an MIT background or a Stanford or a Caltech background to know that the physical understanding of the universe is no new space. The original space is stretching. But how, if you go back 1,000 years, the Ramban, Nachmanides, Maimonides, Rashi, the Talmud, where'd they get this information? Where? It's called Kabbalah, which is just a cop-out. It means it's information. Nachmanides says it straight out in his introduction to the book of Genesis. Where does this information come from? It comes from Sinai. In other words, it's divine input into the world. That doesn't really explain anything, because who knows what that means? I mean, how did Moses see the... Did Moses get the Torah written out, or was it something imprinted in his mind? The actual physics of how it was transmitted is less interesting, to me at least, than the actual fact that this information was transmitted. That the universe starts a speck, and if you pick up any diagram of the universe today from a science point of view, NASA has an excellent, excellent actual diagram you can download. If you look up their site, under NASA, National Aeronautics, NASA, and then under WMAP, the Wilkinson map of the universe, if you search around, you can get a diagram, a two-dimensional diagram of the flow of space, and it starts off as a small point and stretches out, because space stretches. As the universe gets larger, there's no new space made. The original space stretches. In other words, it's not like an onion with new layers added. That's what I mentioned just before. It's the original space stretching. Why a person 1,000 years ago or 900 years ago, the Ramban, or the Rashi, or the Talmud would tell us that there's one physical creation and everything is made from that. It's explicit. It's not like one says A and one says B. It's within commentary, this is it. And it's amazing. Space stretching, that's something we just learned in physics recently. But that's exactly what we're told. There is no new space being made. The universe gets larger by space stretching. So students will often ask, well, stretching into what? Not into a vacuum. A vacuum is space. That speck, which is said not to be larger than a grain of mustard, Gargim Chadal, not larger than a grain of mustard, that's it. That's all the space. Outside of it is not an empty space, not a black hole, not a black space. Outside of it, theologically, you'd say God. Or science-wise, you'd say, new, Mia, who knows, nothing, okay? But it's not a space, because space is in the universe. Our concept is the universe is not stretching into a space. Put it this way, if you had to diagram it, it would be an edge with an inside, but no outside. A concept impossible to conceive, because every edge we know of has an inside and an outside. The outside, if there was, would be, from a theological point, God. From a science point of view, undescribable. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.